Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So a couple of important notes of breaking news in the last hour. Mike Scott mentioned it. Maryland Representative Elijah Cummings, Democrat, chairman of the House Oversight Committee, passing away at the age of 68. The report that it was complications from a longstanding health problem.
Yeah, and April Ryan was on CNN about an hour ago, and she said that he had heart complications. And she said she knew that there was something wrong in September when he didn't show up for a congressional Black caucus meeting. Hmm. But that's all that we know so far, but that's shocking. I mean, I didn't know he was sick. Did you know he was sick?
No, I didn't know that. No, I didn't know that he was gravely ill. That's for certain. Health complications or health issues for a 68-year-old. But no, I didn't know that. So that's unfortunate. On the good news front, you've got what appears to be a deal by Britain with the EU to Brexit. Finally, Boris Johnson announcing that. Now he's got to bring it back to Parliament in the UK for approval, and we'll see how that proceeds. But that should be good news for the markets. That should be good news for the possibility to get a trade deal done with the UK, as Trump and Boris Johnson both said would be done once Brexit occurred back at the G8 summit a couple of months back, or it seems like a couple of months ago. I don't know. I lose track of time. So we'll tackle those topics as more information becomes available. Certainly we'll get back to Brexit this morning. But, of course, the big story locally, which is a national story anytime a teacher strike of this magnitude occurs, is the Chicago teachers are on the picket line this morning.
Yes, they are. So I was talking to my teacher friends yesterday. I'm like, hey, because they all have been ordered to come in at 6:30 this morning to start walking the lines. And a lot of them don't want to be on strike, Dan. That's the thing.
Is that earlier than they get in normally for their work day?
No, it's about the same. Well, they're supposed to be in an hour before, so 7. But, yeah, they have to walk the picket lines. And I was hoping that it was going to be raining this morning.
Wow.
Because I know that sounds heartless and cold, but this strike is just, I know I'm being selfish, but when it comes to sports, it's ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous.
And that is the purpose of K-12 education.
No, it's not.
Program.
But when you have a sports program that makes a playoff game or the playoffs, and if they don't get back to work by October 27th, then they're going to have to forfeit their first round of the championship. Or the playoffs, I should say. Here's Allison Rosati.
After the impact on students and student athletes, one CPS mom we spoke with today is concerned about her two sons' football careers, how they could be affected by the strike. They both play football for Evanston High School, and they are standout players. The team is on a hot streak right now with its best record in 2 decades. They're 6-1.
They need to play this game, absolutely.
Just like in life as well as football, things are going to happen that you're not prepared for. But it's not what happens to you. It's how you react to it.
The Amundsen Vikings had to move tomorrow's game to today so that they could get it before the strike and still be eligible for the playoff.
I'm so glad NBC5 was able to pick up your press release about the Amundsen football team. This is great local news reporting. This must be... And thank you for that. It's a reminder why I haven't watched the network affiliate news in about 2 decades.
No. Well, they wanted to personalize stories and who it affected.
Oh,
so I introduced
yeah.
them to Juanita Askew, who has two sons on the team.
It shouldn't have gotten this far. You know, like everyone knew that these negotiations needed to take place when the school year started. Like by now, it should have been taken care of.
And all CTU is doing is sending Lori Lightfoot a message that they're in charge and not her. Because everything that they offer, they like, except for they want nurses at every school instead of just 1 day a week or sometimes 2 days a week. And that's what the issue is.
That's well, it's more than that. It's social workers, it's nurses, it's blank checks, it's control the schools, it's no school closings. It's the whole thing. It's the it is exactly as you say. We are in charge as we have always been in charge and will remain in charge. And just because we didn't support you in the election doesn't mean that our status as the party in charge has changed at all. And of course, Lori the Lightfoot is playing right along with that, much like Tiny Dancer did, talking tough for a while now, offering conciliatory notes. And all of this is just more of the appeasement of an organization that has destroyed K through 12 education in Chicago with a lot of help, Yeah. But since they're in charge, we start there. Let's go rank order priority. And this is why nobody with the means, virtually nobody with the means to send their kids to a school other than a Chicago public school, if it's not a magnet school or a charter school, does. And this is why people, when they're having families, leave for the suburbs if they're going to stay in Chicagoland to take their kids into school out there, because, of course, there's no way on God's green earth I'm sending my kids to CPS school. If I can't afford the tuition or I can't get them into Peyton or a few of the other magnet schools, then we're out of here because there's no way the neighborhood schools suffice. This is a long-running conspiracy to destroy the future of children in Chicago, overwhelmingly minority, and no one cares.
No one cares.
And so nothing has changed from, what was it, 6-7 years ago now?
It was 7 years ago.
The last
strike?
It was
a 7-day strike.
Nothing's changed. This is exactly the same conversation we had, you here, me at WLS, exactly the same conversation we had 7 years ago. And to go 15 years back from there and 15 years back from there. I mean, maybe some people who actually grew up in Chicago and went to these schools back when they were something much different 3 and 4 generations ago still have some fealty for their alma mater. But in terms of anything that's happened since I was an adult, this is just rinse and repeat failure. Make it bigger. Make it more expensive. But you're producing the same terrible product and preventing most of these kids from even the opportunity to earn the kind of education that will prepare them for success in life, whether it's going on to post-secondary, whether it's going into the workforce. And all this talk is about how much everybody cares about the kids. You can't even, I will say it again. Because why not? We're having the same conversation. The only thing different from 7 years ago is now we know there's also this wide-ranging sex abuse scandal that has been raging inside CPS that also no one cares about and no one talks about except the Chicago Tribune investigative team that did this report, and good for them.
Where are
the trial lawyers? Where are the trial lawyers to go after the deep pockets CPS? Where are the politicians? Where are the parents? Where are the teachers and administrators that talk so much about how they're so in this for the kids and so selfless and they won't tolerate these kids getting shortchanged, but they'll tolerate them getting sexually abused? Or are we going to hear the one-off argument? 500 cases plus over just the last decade? But it's all about, it's all about class sizes and the quality of education, because the quality of education is so outstanding. What about the quality of the teacher's education? What about the quality of the teachers? I don't know. I mean, 2 decades ago, talk about conversations we've been having for that period of time. 2 decades ago, the Sun-Times, of all socialist rags, did a story that 1 in 10 CPS teachers couldn't pass a basic skills test so simple that a high school freshman should be able to pass it. That's 10%. That's 3,000 teachers, 2,500 now. Where does that stand now? Now they won't even administer the basic skills test. Why is that? Why is that?
312-642-5600 is our turnkey dot pro answer line. 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Robert in Oak Brook.
Well, Dan, you hit one thing. Everybody in my family's a teacher. But it's one class size. Back when I was a kid, it was hard enough to teach 25 kids. Now you got 40 kids in the class.
Bull jive.
And you are right about
that's,
you are right
that's
about
crap.
The no, Dan, you're right about the teachers. A lot of them, when you hear them on the news, they can't even say the word "and." They go, "Ah." If you can't understand your teacher, how are you going to learn anything?
Okay, Robert, thanks for the call. And I hate to be tough on you, but I've heard these arguments before. The class size is spurious. First of all, class sizes were bigger historically.
Right. They're smaller now.
Right.
As more people are fleeing the city and leaving CPS.
You also have enrollment that has shrunk. The entire system is getting smaller. School populations are getting smaller. Overrun by students. Nonsense. Mm-hmm. Also, in classic CPS central planning fashion, to the extent that the research shows class size matters, where does it matter? Where does it matter, since everybody is an education expert and is poor through all the scholarship? Where, raise your hand, coalition. Somebody from that dingbat organization, call in. Tell us where it matters. The teachers union. Any teacher, any administrator, CPS, any CPS parent. Tell me where it matters. Do you know the research? Is anybody? They may pay attention or just repeat the talking points you hear from political hacks and union bosses. I'm not going to tell you. Class size matters in some place in K through 12 education. And where it matters is exactly where we have the biggest class sizes in CPS. And where it doesn't matter is where you have the smallest. Because everything is upside down in CPS. I've used this example before. I used it with Karen Lewis 7 years ago during the last teacher strike. Let me ask you something. If this is all about the kids and their education, what about the curriculum? We have known for 30 years that kids best learn foreign languages where? Does anybody know that?
Oh, first 3 years, kindergarten, first grade, second grade.
Primary grades.
Primary grades, yeah.
Where are most foreign languages taught still today?
In high school.
Why?
I don't know why.
Exactly, because it's reversed.
It makes no sense.
Because it's convenient, because if we had to change anything, that'd be difficult because change is hard. But we're real concerned about the kids. How about science? What do we know for 30 years of research about how kids best learn science, since we're so STEM-oriented these days, right? Everybody's so avant-garde, at least to hear them talk. What's the first science class? What's the order of progression of science at the high school level? What's the science class most people take, most freshmen take first? Freshmen.
Biology.
Right. And that's the third in the continuum. That's what it should be. That's first. We know it should be a physical science class, then chemistry, then biology. That's what we know about how kids best learn science. And CPS does it in reverse order. Why? Why? Because they care about kids. Bunch of crap.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
Just a quick financial picture here, snapshot from CPS. I mean, since we're 2012 all over again, let's just update the numbers from the same conversation we had 7 years ago. This from Truth in Accounting. Total assets for Chicago Public Schools, $9.6 billion.
Okay.
Total bills, $19 billion. In point of fact, in terms of its liquidity, CPS has $2.7 billion available to pay $19.8 billion worth of bills. That's $18,900 per Chicago taxpayer. That's $17 billion shortfall. That's because CPS has overspent the budget 15 years straight by about $6.5 billion. And just continues to borrow against tomorrow to pay for yesterday at the rates that a junk-rated borrower would get. And I'm sorry, they want what in terms of raises and what in terms of staff increases and the salaries and benefits associated with that? And where's Lori Lightfoot even to kind of come up with the money that she offered, much less what they are demanding? It's tough. It's a tough situation when there are no serious people in charge on either side of the bargaining table, isn't it? In addition to that, when taxpayers aren't represented at the bargaining table. But again, those taxpayers chose this dynamic. And so they're going to get what they so richly deserve. Everybody deserves everything except criticism. I got it. Everybody deserves a blank check. And Chicago taxpayers, Illinois taxpayers that underwrite CPS seem to be fine with us. Okay. So we'll just keep doing it over and over again. It's Groundhog Day.
Well, what Lori Lightfoot did yesterday, I thought was a pretty bold. She canceled school before CTU even took a strike vote. So I know teachers were not happy with that because she made the first move. Yesterday when she had a press conference around this time or around 9 a.m., she canceled school proactively before they took their strike vote.
Wow.
Well,
that's so impressive. I mean, she's like Dwight D. Eisenhower. I don't know. Winston Churchill. Lori Lightfoot. Wow.
About the children, Dan.
Paradigm shifting. I'm inspired. Oh, you're right. This time it's going to be different. My hope springs eternal for CPS.
It's about the kids.
This is about me. It's not about a power struggle. It's about our kids. And we cannot lose sight of that.
Wow, I've never heard that before. I'm so persuaded. It's all going to be different this time. I promise. Let's get back together. Christ's sake.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. See Michelle Malkin, Sean Hannity, and Laura Logan at Freedom Summit 2019. Tickets on sale now at freedomsummitchicago.com.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Britain is leaving the EU, and productive Illinois families continue to leave Illinois. You don't have a school system in Chicago, you know, without people. Talked about this story the other week. In 2018, nearly 1 in 10 City of Chicago property owners didn't pay property taxes. They just didn't pay. Because they can't. They don't want to. Some combination of the two. As property taxes have destroyed the value of people's homes. And those are disproportionately in the poorer neighborhoods.
And you said business owners, too, were just not paying their property taxes.
Yeah. You have some people going galt. Come and get it. Nobody will. Come and buy it. Nobody will. What about in the areas that actually underwrite City of Chicago and Chicago Public School operations? You know, the half a dozen wards that produce most of the revenue, the 250,000 people that prop up a city of 2.7 million. You think that's sustainable? Less and less so each day. What's their interest in Chicago? People that are getting by or even doing well. Interesting piece from a local outlet, Loop North News. Veteran residential brokers call it a crickets market. As property taxes skyrocket, home sales in Chicago have plummeted. The sound of silence is all that can be heard in much of the city's early autumn home buying market. Veteran residential brokers call it a crickets market. Several of the top city real estate brokers in downtown and Northside neighborhoods saying their open houses went vastly unattended. Quote, "We have many attractive multi-million-dollar condo and mansion listings, and there currently appears to be little to no interest by affluent would-be purchasers in even taking a tour." This write-up by Don DeBat at this Loop North News. There's radio silence throughout the city and suburbs, from downtown Chicago to Lake Forest, Oak Park to St. Charles. The only properties that are moving are priced under $500,000, observed three city and suburban brokers. The demand is strong for mid-priced homes and two to four flats and a few ultra-expensive condos. But the existing inventory time for properties with more than 3,000 square feet is three times that of those with properties with less than 3,000 square feet. By the way, even at that price point, $500,000 and down, as we've documented here for, I don't know, years. Yeah. You can get out, you can move your property, but it's not going to be at a profit. you're lucky you get to sell to minimize your ongoing losses, where those in the upper reaches of the market are just watching their equity and consequently home value whittled away on a daily basis, and they can't get out unless they want to, you know, try to find the bottom of what it would actually take to move a seven-figure property or even a high six-figure property.
Yeah. Well, there's a house across the street from me. had an open house. One person showed up. One. Because it's way overpriced and nobody wants to pay the taxes on that thing.
I thought that I was just spewing right-wing talking points when we were talking about math and the actual market on the ground. But apparently some real estate professionals are backing what I've been saying and some other people have been saying for years. Tried to communicate during election seasons to no avail. Okay. Phil Chiricotti, editor of Data Analytics Illinois, quote, while the wealthy have an abundance of world-class choices, they're also facing a fiscal crisis, a cap on tax deductions, excessive property taxes, ballooning assessments, and a higher transfer tax on luxury sales. Yeah. What are we going to tell our sellers? One principal at a brokerage firm recently said at one of the closed-door roundtable meetings that brokerage firms are having to figure out what the hell to do. Buyers are worried about a graduated state income tax, growing concerns over the next economic contraction, a big increase in luxury rentals, meaningful new construction, and reduced foreign buying. I've never seen the city home market this slow, even during the Great Recession of 2008, observed another veteran Northside broker. And I'm sorry, what's the plan coming from City Hall? Graduate property taxes? Continue to spend beyond your means, issuing the desire to issue blank checks, which will not be accepted yet per the strike. Blank checks to the Chicago Teachers Union and to the other unions. From wirepoints.com. This excellent four-part series that our friend Ted Dabrowski and his colleague John Klingner did on the exodus from Illinois.
Yeah.
In 2016, Illinois lost more than 9,200 tax filers earning $200,000 or more, while only 4,700 such filers moved into Illinois. The net result was a loss of more than 4,500 wealthy Illinois tax filers, many of those in Chicago. On a net basis, Illinois lost more wealthy residents per capita than any other state in the nation except New York in 2016. That's a small share of the people lost out migration, but of course, because they're high earners, they're responsible for the largest share of the income that Illinois is losing to other states. Yeah. 11% of the net tax filers who left is what they represent, but they accounted for more than half of the $5 billion net loss in adjusted gross income in 2016. These 11% of high-income filers accounting for half, $2.5 billion of adjusted gross income net loss to the state. Is that a pro-growth environment, do you think? That going to help prop up the housing markets? Underwrite one of all of these wonderful government enterprises and services that we like to lead with in this government-centric city and state. Jim in Naperville, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Dan, I'll tell you what. You know what? We sold our house years ago. I'm renting, and you know what? I still pay the taxes. I'm paying my taxes for my kids, you know, through my landlord to get the A+. My kids are getting all A's in the best schools in the state of Illinois. Okay, that's not to say the nation, but I'll tell you this: you know, this misnomer that of home ownership. You know, you don't own your home. You don't. Once you pay it off from the bank, or you think, oh, okay, I'm gonna have a mortgage. I'm gonna pay it off from the bank. I own my home. No, the state owns it.
Now,
okay,
you know who
the
actually
state,
owns
unless
it?
Unless you pay your taxes, they're gonna come get it.
Yeah. The good news is nobody wants to buy it at auction. But here's the thing: you know who actually owns it? I mean, it functionally owns it.
Mm-hmm.
The public sector unions. Because your home is collateral for their pension. That's all it is. It's collateral for their pension. The state takes your home and puts it up as collateral for somebody else's public sector pension. That's what's actually happening. So you're, thanks for the call, Jim. I mean, I get what you're saying. You're exactly right. It's just, I'm just saying it in a different way, more specifically. But that's what, that's the deal. Marvin in Burlington, Wisconsin.
Yeah, good morning. Nice to talk to you again. I just wondered how courageous Lori Lightfoot is. I mean, Chicago's having trouble attracting people. I have an idea. Maybe they should de-charter the Chicago public schools, de-charter the union, take it off the books completely, let private schools come in, pay them, and they run it like academies. Separate the boys from the girls, which always helps academically, uniforms, and run it that way. Get rid of all the lunacy of the curricula that they want to foist on people at, I want to say Pershing Roll, but I know they're not there anymore. Get rid of the whole administrative staff, everything, and start from scratch. Let's just see how courageous she is. And I bet you'd have people coming from, hey, Chicago's redoing their schools. They're going to start over, start from scratch, a whole new program.
Thanks for the call, Marvin. Candace in Mount Pleasant, Wisconsin.
Hey, I started tutoring. Good morning, by the way. I started tutoring kids that are fourth and fifth grade. That's the grade that they wanted me to tutor. I'm not going to say with whom or whatnot. But let me tell you something. These kids, in reading and writing, it's like a plague. They don't want to read and write because of their stupid phones and notebooks. I'm telling you, if I was a parent, I would burn those things. There needs to be powwows where parents actually get rid of all that stuff. It's like a cancer to them, reading, okay? Because they're so uncomfortable with it, and they're so slow at it. Fourth and fifth grade kids up here in Racine, Kenosha area are reading, the kids that I'm meeting, second grade level easily, first grade level, some of them. Most of them is like a second grade level. Math, oh my God, Common Core has destroyed these kids. Okay, they're doing like the math they are struggling with. This is the easiest math. I was doing this math in second, third grade. Okay, so I'm shocked, and it just makes my blood boil. Okay, because these kids are so great. And I don't think that, I think that what we're doing is, I think that we need to start going straight to the parents and handing out flyers and stuff, just like I work on campaigns. I am tempted to take that article that I sent you last night, Dan Proft, from the Epoch Times, and distribute stuff like that, because I think the parents, it's not even about these unions anymore. So what was the whole point of the public schools to begin with? And like, what is their whole angle? I think that you need to plant the seed in the parents, because they keep talking about all these things to distract them, when really it's not about education at all. It's about collectivism. And if the kids don't have an education, they're just a subject. And I don't think the parents really realize what's going on. That's what's really going on. It's so insidious. They don't want the kids to be smart. They don't want them to be able to read, because if they can, they're going to be independent one day and not need the government.
Thanks for the call, Candace. Ed in Oak Brook.
Yeah, you know what? I could end this strike in about 1 hour, because all I would say, we're just going to file bankruptcy. I would offer them a 20% pay cut, and I would make them pay half of their pension and all of that good stuff, because once you threaten bankruptcy, you know what? They're going to fall in line, because they're going to be in line with every other creditor for the school system, even the city. So just say we're going bankrupt, and then let's see how they melt before that. Because right now it's none of their money, and that's why they just throw it back out there to those teachers.
Well, there is. Thanks for the call, Ed. Unfortunately, Chicago would need to get state authorization to file for bankruptcy, reorganization, bring in an emergency manager like Detroit did. So
have we reached that point?
Yeah, we reached it long ago. Does anybody have the courage to do that? I mean, here's the thing. Bankruptcy, PATCO, the teachers, hold the line on the salaries and benefits, make them contribute more to their pensions. voucherize, scholarshipize the whole system. Yeah, sure. Now, these are not new ideas. They've been thought about. They've been debated. There is no political will to do anything other than try to keep the scam going. So you're pretending that people are befuddled as to what we should do. Like they're trying to get to a plausible solution that is actually in the interests of the mission, which is to educate children. They're not. The system is for the adults. To the extent kids, any kid comes out of CPS prepared for success at the next level of the workforce, that's accidental, or he would have anyway. I mean, if you don't understand what the end game is, and Candace got close to it, then you can't comprehend what's going on or why it's going on. The why it's going on is because they're not interested in the mission you think they should pursue. They're not interested in the stated goals of the system. They're interested in political power, their ideological agenda, and oh, by the way, let's make sure we all have financial security while we prosecute the case and prepare, groom the kids to be good little leftists. JP in Northwest Indiana.
Hey, guys. Good morning. Love you guys. Love your show. I just want to point out, in Northwest Indiana, on average, teachers make about $45,000 a year. Guess who's going to work today?
Thanks, JP. Here in Illinois, we got a new state law that says teachers can't make less than 40. Oh, teachers, yeah, we can't get good teachers because of the compensation's too low. No, lie. Just another lie. Lies upon lies upon lies. People buy them. That's why you keep receiving them. And you vote for the liars. Oh, this is so awful. I'm tired of being lied to. Well, then stop voting for liars. No, I don't want to. Okay. Well, then don't complain about being lied to. I don't know. You got to pick your poison there, apparently. Speaking of Northwest Indiana, did you see this? Piece of the Northwest Indiana Times. Welcoming Midland Metal Products, formerly of 700 South Wabash in Chicago since 1921. Just moved from Bridgeport to Hammond. Made a $7 million investment in a 112,000 square foot plant in Hammond, expanding by 15,000 square feet. It's footprint, adding powder coating and printing operations, employing 135 workers and still hiring. Yeah, the company faced too much uncertainty about its costs in Illinois. So as the principal said, company president Marcus McDonald, this location in Hammond and this facility were the perfect solution. And the chorus continues to sing and no one listens.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. This hasn't gotten enough attention. Subordinated to the Dem Socialist debate the other night, subordinated to the flap with the Trump administration's decision to withdraw troops from northern Syria. But thankfully, Cheryl Atkinson, our friend and excellent investigative reporter, picked up on this, writing about it in The Hill, talking about the ABC News combat video from the front in northern Syria. Turks invading northern Syria, except not exactly.
Killing civilians, innocent civilians, they said, too, while they showed it.
Yeah, except the video, as you probably know by now, we mentioned yesterday, was a military demonstration exercise at a Kentucky gun range.
All right, how the heck does that happen? It is so irresponsible for them to do that. And then they didn't even own up to it. They just apologized. But no, how did that happen? How desperate were you? What happened behind the scenes is what I want to know.
They issued a correction. We've taken down the video after after questions were raised about its accuracy. ABC News regrets the error. According to National Review, the alleged error was uncovered by social media users who compare the combat footage to a YouTube video of this Kentucky military show I just described. But Cheryl Atkinson makes the point, that's not the end of the story. It's yet another in a long series of pretty serious media mistakes that should never have happened and arguably would not have if appropriate journalistic standards had been deployed. And she makes the point that, again, we don't have journalism. We have storytellers who have a preordained story and they're looking for evidence to support the stories they want to tell. Writes Atkinson, I can't help but think that part of the problem might be the video seemed to fit in so perfectly with the narrative the media and other interests have been pummeling viewers with for a week. Had the video not shown what many wanted to see, it might have been treated more critically on the front end rather than represented as a great exclusive ABC News get that was shown to millions of its evening news and morning news viewers. But she also says, you know, it also demands more questions. There's correction and then you walk away from something as egregious as that. Questions like, who brought the video to ABC? How did they represent it? What was the process ABC used to try to verify the video was what they presented it to be? Who did ABC believe shot the combat video? Did they pay for it, or did someone just offer to give it to them out of the blue? What was the motivation of those who misrepresented the video? Yeah,
you know what my question? No, my question too is, how many times has this happened before, where they've aired the wrong footage to make us believe something that's not to be true? I'm done with them. That's. I know you don't watch local news, but.
Well, that wasn't local news.
No, it was national news, which is even worse.
That's what Atkinson suggests, I mean, in terms of her recommendation. Now more than ever, we should be mindful that these are important, complex topics about which competing interests try to further their own narratives. The best a viewer can do in this environment is not necessarily believe much of anything presented to them at first blush, no matter how many people say it's true, unless there's a way to independently verify what they see. It's a sad commentary on the state of journalism. And that commentary was followed up by Megyn Kelly.
She's back.
She was on with Tucker Carlson last night, her first interview since she got ash canned by NBC News.
Yeah.
And they had a conversation about journalists as partisans. Some of the questions, the way questions are asked in debates by Gloria Vanderbilt's kid or the cricket, Don Lamone. Megyn Kelly had this to say.
I mean, you have journalists who feel that their first obligation is to help a candidate or hurt another candidate.
Yeah.
That's not journalism.
Oh, 100%. And this goes back to right before Trump was elected, Jorge Ramos of Univision came on my show, and we had a very heartfelt discussion about journalism in America, and he made a strong plea for journalists to abandon neutrality. He said, that's over. You've got to come out and you've got to say, Trump's a racist, Trump's a misogynist, Trump's a bigot. So whatever your view is, you've got to say it and you've got to sell it, and that the time for neutrality is past. And I do believe he's persuaded, and others have come to their own conclusion, that that's the way forward. That's why we had a question. There was another CNN debate where Don Lemon specifically said, how do you answer voters who prioritize the economy over Trump's bigotry? Right? So there's a judgment in there.
A judgment.
I'm just saying. Okay, so fine. Many people may agree with that, but it's the anchor's subjective judgment, and it doesn't belong, in my view, in a debate question. Same way as the New York Times is arguing, the old schoolers with the young folks, about whether the Times should be, quote, part of the resistance.
Yeah, what you have is, I would go one step further. You have these pundits / journalists. I mean, they're basically indistinguishable terms now, that are actually presenting the talking points for the candidates to repeat back to them. You want to ask, do you think Trump is a bigot? Fine.
You don't want them to say Trump is a bigot.
No, you do. The Don Lemon, Trump is a bigot. We know this. And then you repeat that back to me. Just confirm what I said to be true, or just accept what I said to be true. You don't need to say it. I got you here. We'll do a little tag team. It's interesting to me, and I think this is one of the tells. Number one, the lack of presentation of source material. Well, on this show, when we talk about topics, we present source material that are backing up our positions, the arguments we're making, the questions we're asking. That's number one. Number two, the complete lack of inquisitiveness by the D.C. press corps. they don't do reporting and suggest these are some important questions that we don't know the answers to. We need to find out. This is where the story could potentially lead. There's no couching of maybe we're looking into this. This raises that question. It's all edicts that are being issued by quote unquote reporters, journalists, pundits, because it's an exercise in gaslighting you to believe what they're saying and then regurgitate it back to your friends and colleagues. And that's not journalism, because they're not journalists. They're political operatives. Tara in Elgin, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning. I just was sitting here thinking about that video, and all I could picture was the scene from Running Man where he's shooting all the civilians, you know, not but they're not civilians, and he's not shooting them. And I think because I saw it in my late teens, early 20s, that is formatted my entire political opinion on truth-telling. And I think I keep waiting for Dweezil Zappa to come out from behind the curtain. Save the world.
Dweezil Zappa reference. Wow, that's impressive. Thanks for the call, Tara. I love the Running Man reference, too, right? Yeah, the phony video to whip up the audience into, you know, believing who Richard Dawson says is evil and who Richard Dawson says is good, and these good versus evil battles. It really is like a high-tech game show, isn't it? That's a really good analogy. By the way, Megyn Kelly went on to say, to sort of recount, I should say, the founding of Fox News and how things, you know, what essentially gave rise to Fox News and how things have changed.
Fox News was founded all, you know, 1996, right? They just had their birthday on the premise that the other side of the stories weren't being told and that half of the country was being ignored and that if you did fair and balanced news, the people would watch. And there was a premise that the other media, the mainstream media, maybe they weren't far left, right? But that there was a baked-in bias against people who believe in homeschooling, who believe in a pro-life position, who might have a gun, right? And so they made a whole empire based on programming to those people. I think what's happened now on the other half of the country, on sort of the mainstream, is they've embraced it. It was sort of passive, and now it's active. Now it's, let's work. He's too bad. We have to work together.
Right.
We'll be judged. History will judge us as whether we were for or against this man.
And it's not only he's too bad, as we've tried to emphasize, it's you're too bad. You listening who voted for Trump.
Right. We're deplorables.
Regardless of whether you held your nose and did it, regardless of if you have a nuanced view of Trump, there's some things you like, some things you don't. There is no distinguishing between people's perspectives. Here's the skirmish line. You're on one side or the other. In point of fact, it's funny because for all of the hand-wringing the D.C. press corps has offered about being called an enemy of the people, they see you, deplorables, as the enemy. And they're the people. Right? They should be in charge. You're getting in the way. Do what they say, or else they're going to teach you a lesson. For example, along with their Democrat socialist fellow travelers, cooking up investigations that beset the administration and doing number one, get them out of office in 2020. Number two, if you can, get them out of office before 2020.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy continuing on our review of Tucker Carlson's interview with Megyn Kelly, making her first appearance, and she was kicked out of NBC.
What did you think of her new hairdo? Did you even notice it, Dan?
I don't see gender. In fact,
her hairdo. Yeah. Oh,
it looked. Her hairdo is the same as Tucker Carlson's.
Yeah, exactly. I think basically. They go to the same stylist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But of course,
but she looked beautiful.
The pink tax. He pays less for his
right.
Bob.
Right.
That's outrageous. Yeah. Keith Ellison said so. they also took up what's going on over at NBC per the Ronan Farrow book, Catch and Kill. and Matt Lauer's open letter decrying the rape allegations against him now contained in that book.
Saying it was consensual and all that.
So what about, you know, the Me Too movement, this one of the leading news organizations in the country, and how they've handled the apparently rampant sexual harassment, maybe worse, that was going on right under their noses with their leading man, Matt Lauer. Here's what Megyn Kelly had to say about that.
And I want your reaction to this quote. Farrow brings a recording made by the NYPD to NBC, and in it, Harvey Weinstein admits that he abused an Italian model. On tape, Noah Oppenheim, head of the news division, responds this way, quote, "My view is that the tape and Harvey Weinstein grabbing a lady's breasts a couple of years ago, that's not national news." Does that surprise you, having worked there?
You know, nothing surprises me anymore, Tucker, in this industry. As I've watched the Ronan story unfold as his book has come out, Ronan Farrow, Catch and Kill, the number one thing I've wanted to know is, what did they know and when did they know it?
Right.
As I've been reporting on this story, even while I was at NBC, I talked to Ronan, I talked to his producer, Rich McHugh, I talked to Rose McGowan, I talked to many Harvey Weinstein victims and accusers, and was getting to the bottom of what NBC knew while I was there, and then just independently. And the question is, what did they know about Matt Lauer prior to the time the woman came forward who was ultimately his downfall? She came forward, her name is Brooke Nevels, made an allegation against Matt Lauer, and the company's whole defense to Ronan's book essentially has been, that's the first we ever knew about Matt Lauer. There was no deal between us and Harvey Weinstein to cover up for Harvey Weinstein so that he wouldn't report on Matt Lauer, because we didn't even know that Matt Lauer was doing this. We had no notice of it whatsoever.
Remember, if you have to go back to this, NBC passed on Ronan Farrow's investigative story.
Right, and then he went to The New Yorker, and that's how the story unfolded on that, started the whole Me Too movement.
Yeah. So they were so Noah Oppenheim, the head of NBC News, running interference for Harvey Weinstein, and Megyn Kelly certainly suggesting, and I don't think without foundation, that they're being less than honest about what exactly they knew or should have known, and when they say they knew or should have known it about Lauer. Kelly also makes the point, don't forget she's an attorney, this is a good catch by her. She addresses the NBC News blanket defense. There have been no settlements made.
Yeah, which is not true.
Well, it's a...
well, it's a way that you word it when you part ways, how they throw in some extra cash for you to
correct.
Be quiet.
It's a little bit of rhetorical artifice, and she explains.
No settlements of any kind. No settlements. Well, that's a legal sleight of hand. You can get paid out as a sexual harassment victim in something other than a settlement. You can get what's called enhanced severance. That's the situation where the receptionist is suddenly getting a seven-figure goodbye. She was like an amazing typist, did so well, right? And it's just severance. It's not a settlement. It's just like, hey, and by the way, if you could just be really quiet about NBC forevermore, we'd really appreciate it. That's what we need to know. They haven't gotten specific about what monies were paid out to whom. Show us the money. The number one thing that needs to happen now is they need to release any and all Matt Lauer accusers from their confidentiality agreements. NBC says it has nothing to hide. Great. Let's not hide anything. Show us all of the agreements, the enhanced severance agreements that were reached, or at least the numbers, so we can see which ones pop out, which ones are super high. And are they all women? And do they all have a connection with Matt Lauer? And number two, release the women from their confidentiality obligations.
What do you think about that?
312-642-5600 is our turnkey to Pro Answer line. They should release all the women from their confidentiality agreements, because NBC has egg on their face right now. And Megyn Kelly helped. Well, she helped promote that. I mean, just tell the truth last night, so the world can know what NBC is really doing.
Well, it's sure. I mean, the infamous phraseology of the Amazon Post, democracy dies in the darkness. And, of course, as a part of the vanguard in the Fourth Estate, I mean, NBC News wants to be as perfectly transparent as they can be to set a standard for others to follow, of course. So now we have two of the leading news agencies in the country just this week. Starting with the Farrell book, but, I mean, Megyn Kelly is really sort of getting to the crux of the issue here, being called out legitimately. What about that, NBC News? We have nothing to hide, so don't force anybody to hide, right? Isn't that the standard you're applying to the president? Full compliance. Again, lead by example. That's happening at NBC News, where it appears that perhaps they were running interference for multiple alleged sexual predators. I think that's pretty serious. And over at ABC News, we have all kinds of questions about them posting agitprop as reporting for a story they want to tell about what's happening in northern Syria since the Trump troop withdrawal. And there's no questions being asked about how they came about this video, per Cheryl Atkinson, how they came about this video and the processes they went through to make the decision to air it. Let's have a full airing of that as well, how you got to that decision, the same way they would hold politicians to account for how they got to their decisions. It's a public trust issue, isn't it? I understand they're not government officials. They're just the government news corps. I understand that. They don't have the same responsibilities technically, but it, in terms of the public trust that they like to, the phrase they like to bandy about so much, you'd think they'd want to hold themselves out to answer all questions, make sure all questions are asked and answers provided. The whole thing is exhausted so that people can have faith in the quality of their news reporting and, frankly, the consistency of their corporate culture with the culture they're otherwise promoting. What do you say, NBC, ABC?
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. See Michelle Malkin, Sean Hannity, and Laura Logan at Freedom Summit 2019. Tickets on sale now at freedomsummitchicago.com.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. We mentioned this yesterday, but it bears repeating. Sort of a remarkable exchange between Sean Casten. He is the socialist congressman from the western suburbs.
How that happened, I will always be scratching my head.
This state's a death cult. That's how it happens. So we want, apparently, the majority of the electorate, at least recently, wants to elect people that will advance the destruction of the Chicagoland area and the state as quickly as possible. Sean Casten's certainly up to the task. He had a town hall meeting, Glendale Heights. A guy asks him, hey, I asked you 6 months ago, you dodged. I'm going to ask you again. What do you say to the anti-Semitism and the anti-Semitic comics of your colleague Ilhan Omar? And Casten goes on to explain that he voted for the resolution condemning hate of all forms that was prompted by Ilhan Omar's hatred. And he called it the single hardest vote he's had to cast as a member of Congress to condemn hate. It seemed to me a rather easy vote, but it was difficult for him, and here's why.
Ilhan Omar is an anti-Semite. Your response makes me believe that you're at least okay with her comments, if not in agreement. So will you at least repudiate her and her fellow anti-Semites in Congress?
Dan Crenshaw, the new Republican who's going to maybe seal with the other bench. Last amendment he came up was an amendment to say we're going to add a rider on this bill that said that illegals can't vote. And I sat there and I said, you know what? You're not allowed to vote if you're not a citizen. That's already happened. Why are you doing that? The reason you're doing that is because you are a racist, because you are trying to appeal to people who will vote for you if you stand up and oppose Brown people.
So the response was Dan Crenshaw issued or attached this rider to the resolution condemning hate that said illegal immigrants should not have the right to vote in this country. And Sean Casten's perspective is he is a racist. That's what he said. Because he is just signaling to his voters that support me because I hate brown and black people, I guess. So I'm a little perplexed. Does that mean that it is racist to oppose the right to vote to people here illegally? Is that racist? Because I know it's the law. But if the law is racist, then Sean Casten doesn't support it and would ostensibly like to change it, right? Doesn't that logically follow? Dan Crenshaw's responded, sort of giving him the back of the hand, dismissing his name-calling as just that. He says, says he's never spoken to Sean Kasten.
No, and he said when you can't articulate a coherent argument, you resort to calling your political opponents racists.
It also is, you know, the classic leftist ploy of projecting onto others who you are. Or in this, and in this case, I shouldn't say or, and in this case, running interference for one of your hateful colleagues by projecting onto other people what she is talking about, Ilhan Omar. For more on this topic, we're pleased to be joined by Jeannie Ives. She's the Republican candidate who's challenging Sean Kasten for that seat come November of 2020. Jeannie, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on, Dan and Amy.
So did people know Dan Crenshaw because of the eye patch, because of the ridicule he received at Saturday Night Live before they all made up? And he's a combat veteran, Navy SEAL, and he's called a racist for attaching that amendment to that resolution condemning hate. How do you respond to that characterization?
Well, it's pretty depressing to have somebody like Sean Kasten representing us in Congress, because that he's gotten nothing done on the policy agenda, and now he's calling American war heroes names when he can't win a political argument. And, it's not the first time that Sean Kasten has called names. We also have him on tape calling people who don't believe in universal health care greedy, and people who don't want to pay more taxes greedy. Now we're the state with the highest tax burden on anyone, and we're greedy because we don't want to pay more to a predatory government that doesn't deliver services. This is the left. And by the way, it's not just people like me that they've called names. It's not just people like Dan Crenshaw. The entire left feels this way. Also, there was a story that USAA did today, and it's about a journalist that they sent back to his hometown in Ohio, in Appalachian. They wanted to find out what's up with Trump and everything. And in the article, they also say that an African-American Trump supporter says, either you believe the way they believe, or you're a racist or a homophobe. The reason I'm working is Trump is because of what Trump's done. I just want to put my hard hat on and go to work every day.
I mean,
so it doesn't matter who you are. You're all called a name.
Well, if Kasten believes it's racist to propose illegal immigrants not be allowed to vote, does he propose any changing of the law to allow for non-citizens to vote?
Well, you know, he obviously cares more about illegal immigrants than he does American citizens. We know that for a fact. We also know that his party feels that way as well. And by the way, Dan Crenshaw was right to introduce such a bill, because in the state of Illinois, they passed legislation saying that illegal immigrants can sit as student trustees on our public university boards. And on those boards, they also vote. So it's not it's not uncommon to have this happen. You've also had states say that in local elections, they let non-citizens vote as well.
Yeah.
So maybe we should find out why Crenshaw, proposed such legislation.
Well, and also you have the leading lights of the left, including all those who raised their hands on the dais during a Democrat-Socialist debate, presidential debate, say, well, people in this country here legally should be entitled to health care coverage. You have people like Julian Castro saying, the way that you eliminate illegal border crossings is to stop treating them as illegal acts, decriminalize illegal border crossings. So if they're not illegal acts, then somebody's just here legally. And why shouldn't they? And they get welfare state benefits as they so desire. So what's the next step? As you mentioned, there are localities that are allowing people in this country legally to vote. So why not just codify it altogether? We're not going to make no distinctions. The open borders crowd make no distinctions between citizens and non-citizens. So why not extend the franchise to non-citizens? That's not illogical, given the positions that they're taking on those issues I just mentioned.
No, and there's no doubt if you give them more power, they will do this. And they will absolutely destroy the very fabric of what it means to be an American, and the rights that are conferred to people that have gone through the process legally to become an immigrant here and to actually become a citizen. And, you know, just the other day, I was at a meeting, and a guy who had been here for about 30 years from Eastern Europe and immigrated here was came to a Republican meeting to seek out a common group of people that he can help fight back socialism, because when he left a socialist country when he was 18 and he wanted nothing to do with it. And then the following week, he was going to actually become a citizen. And he felt at this point, you know, he's got to take on the fight himself. You know, God bless him. Those are the types of people that we want here, the people that respect American citizenship. Unfortunately, Sean Kasten and his like, don't do that. As far as name-calling, another interesting thing is I was at a party, a home party, just a home meet-and-greet with some people in Naperville yesterday. And the host of the party actually put it out on this, you know, neighborhood sort of blog site saying, hey, come meet Jeannie Ives, just find out who she is. And they were appalled at the hateful remarks that they got in response to just a simple invitation to come meet at their lovely home in Naperville.
Well, sure. I mean, by the way, I mean, they're the paragons of civility, those on the left, right? That's the like Sean Kasten, one of their ideological leaders, whose ideological leader is Dan Savage. So he said in a WTTW debate back in 2018 during the election, Dan Savage, who promotes mandatory abortion. Dan Savage, who said Republicans should die. Mm-hmm. Sean Kasten, in keeping with that, I mean, just last year compared Trump to Osama bin Laden. He said that Osama bin Laden and Trump have a lot in common. So, I mean, I'm fascinated, and I'm sure you'll be fascinated to learn on the trail how people want to square the circle when it comes to civility with some of the things Sean Kasten and those that he looks to for guidance have to say about people with whom they disagree and about just people in general in terms of their existence.
Well, I told the group last night, I said, look, if you don't push back when you're confronted with it, then we're not going to win this. Everybody needs to be all in. We can't be silent about it. The name calling is not warranted, and it's just their way of escaping any responsibility for the policy choices that they have made that has really destroyed the state of Illinois. And if you let people like Sean Kasten go to Congress again, they will destroy the nation as a whole. They will give away your money and your citizenship. And by the way, when they're calling people like me names, just remember that they're really after you, because it's your values that, you know, stand in the way of their utopian ideals, and it's your pocketbook that they need to pick in order to pay for their socialist dreams. So they're coming after you.
Yeah. Has Sean Kasten authored any bills in D.C.? Has he done or accomplished anything?
He voted for a unbalanced budget that blew through any spending caps that were in place, a two-year unbalanced budget. So he's not good on the fiscal issues. He's got a multi-step plan to go to Medicare for All, which would destroy private insurance. He's all about climate change and thinks that's the biggest threat that we have. So he's not solved any problem at all, and then has asked for a pay raise. This is who he is.
And how do you deal with, the Trump issue? You have Republicans in the state who routinely run from any opportunity to defend themselves, so much less anybody else with an R. But Trump is not popular in Illinois. He's not popular in suburban Chicagoland. So how do you deal with that when I'm sure you'll be cast by Sean Kasten and others as, Trump's right-hand lady?
Well, they like to use the word extreme because they think it sums up everything. But nobody ran against both parties more than I did during my time in Springfield and, running against Bruce Rauner, quite frankly. So to me, it's all about the policy. And so I just ask people, well, what policy would you like to discuss that Donald Trump has either advocated for or put in place? And we'll have a policy discussion. It's not going to go much further than that. But I recognize that Donald Trump has been attacked since November 9th, 2016. And as far as Kasten goes, you know, his entire checklist of things to do was impeach Trump, impeach Kavanaugh, back to impeach Trump, back to ask for a pay raise, back to pass an unbalanced budget, back to impeach Trump. I mean, the guy is, fixated on this idea that the president needs to be impeached when we're about a year away from the election, you can let the people decide.
She is former state representative and now GOP congressional candidate in Illinois 6, Jeannie Ives. Jeannie, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me on.
And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So Pelosi and Pagliacci, with Steny Hoyer in tow, went to meet with the president yesterday about the matter of troop withdrawal from Syria. And then they left the meeting because, people were mean. Chuck Schumer, Pagliacci there, rallying to the defense of poor little Nancy.
I asked the president what his plan was to contain ISIS. He didn't really have one. He said the Turks and the Syrians will guard the ISIS prisoners. I said, is there any intelligence evidence that the Turks and the Syrians will have the same interest that the Kurds or we did in guarding ISIS? And the Secretary of Defense was, thank God he was honest, he said, we don't have that evidence. He was insulting, particularly to the speaker. She kept her cool completely. But he called her a third-rate politician. He said that there are communists involved and you guys might like that. I mean, this was not a dialogue. It was sort of a diatribe, a nasty diatribe, focused on the facts, particularly the fact of how to curtail ISIS.
And Steny Hoyer said, you know, this is the reason we walked out.
You're going to hear the president say we walked out. We were offended deeply by his treatment of the Speaker of the House of Representatives.
Oh, no.
Well, she said, too, that she's going to pray for him because she doesn't think that he's well.
Go ahead. We witnessed on the part of the president was a meltdown.
He said that there are communists involved.
Yeah, and then Kevin McCarthy was also at that meeting, had a completely different take.
When there is a time of crisis, leaders should stay, whether they like what is said or not.
You know, who had the temper tantrum? You know, they're the ones who walked out of the meeting.
Who cares? Who cares that a crossword was said? I mean, he's talking to people who've spent 3 years accusing him of being a Russian agent and treason. Oh, and he called you a third-rate politician? Oh, heavens.
Well, they never brought up the impeachment.
Did the impeachment inquiry come up in these conversations at all?
No, it didn't come up. It did not come up. Not at all.
Sort of the elephant in the room doesn't need to be stated explicitly. That's sort of beyond the point. Oh, gosh. Steny Hoyer's delicate sensibilities were offended on behalf of the speaker. Pagliacci broke into tears over the speaker's poor treatment. Let me tell you something. I get civil discourse and the obligatory paeans to civil discourse. But please forgive me if I won't decry the president sending a bon mot or two across the bow of Nancy Pelosi and, frankly, the others in attendance for how they've conducted themselves over the last 3 years. Boo frickin' who. Now let's get to the substance of the policy decisions and the reality on the ground in the Middle East and stop worrying about every politician's delicate egos. They can go pound sand. For more on this, the substance of it, we're pleased to be joined again by our friend Dr. Zuhdi Jasser, president of the American Islamic Forum for Democracy, co-founder of the Muslim Reform Movement, former U.S. Navy lieutenant commander, and author of the book A Battle for the Soul of Islam. Dr. Jasser, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
It's good to be with you, Dan. Thanks for having me.
All right. And I know last time we talked about Syria, we had a conversation about the White Helmets, the sort of civilian volunteer force that was doing rescue and recovery from the Assad-directed bombings of civilians and this horrible civil war that took the lives of half a million Syrians. So I suspect you may not agree with the president's decision to withdraw here. If that is the case, what do you say to the explanation that's been offered by Defense Secretary Esper as well as Rand Paul and others who support the president's decision, that, look, Turkey was coming in regardless, and so it was a question of using a few dozen soldiers as tripwires or getting them out.
Yeah, you know, I don't disagree with removing troops eventually. What I have a problem with is the impulsivity and the lack of trajectory that was done. And I have to tell you, as you said at the opening, it is beyond frustrating to hear politicians continue, the Democrats especially, continue to exploit Syria and the human disaster there happening for political one-upsmanship, where Susan Rice and others were doing the rounds to sell her book and ignoring the fact that they paid billions, hundreds of billions in ransom to Iran, half a million dead, 10 million displaced under an Obama policy that created this genocide, and he turned a blind eye to it, and all the Democrats turned a blind eye to it. They never talked about the Kurds. They never cared about the Kurds. They never cared about what created ISIS for 8 years, and now they all of a sudden seem to do so because they're so anti-Trump. So that's on the one hand. I think a conservative argument being had right now within the conservative community is, okay, fine, we want to remove our troops. We don't want troops everywhere on the planet for no reason. But you can't just remove sort of this, there's been a relative silence in Syria over the last year and a half. And our troops, they may have, you could characterize that as a tripwire, or you could characterize it as sort of a Jenga game where you've got a piece, which our troops provide, that's on the bottom balancing this thing. And he just basically pulled it impulsively. And our only allies, save Israel in the region, or the Kurds. Not one American has ever been killed in a Kurdish area, and that's in northern Iraq and northern Syria. And if we're going to move out, I have a hard time believing, as much as I have great respect for Secretary Pompeo, yesterday for him to say that the Turks were going to come in no matter what and basically declare war on American troops, I find hard to believe. So what I don't get is why the hastiness. You want to remove our troops and figure out how to keep the Kurds safe? Present it publicly quickly, say that we're going to have a summit and we're not going to let a NATO ally run over our troops. No, instead, we pulled out so quickly, Dan, we had to blow up our own material yesterday with rockets to destroy the anti-ISIS headquarters that we had. And meanwhile, there's a 20-mile corridor, which we've basically given Erdogan the green light to. They're not bombing just military places for Kurds. They're actually destroying neighborhoods, displacing hundreds of thousands, committing war crimes, and they want to continue an ethnic cleansing where we've allowed a strategy that Russia, Iran, and Turkey seem to all of a sudden have aligned on, which is a weird alignment, by the way. And then we're sort of banking on the fact that the Salafi jihadists of the Turks, which is the Muslim Brotherhood of Turkey, which radicalized the Syrian population for the last 8 years, is not going to be radicalizing them in the future, when in fact they are going to do so much more so than ever the Kurds did.
Well, what do you make, too, of this letter that President Trump wrote Erdogan 3 days prior to pulling out the troops?
You know, listen, it was hard to understand. I think, on the one hand, how will that play in America? I think Americans elected President Trump because they didn't want an elitist sort of foreign policy pencil neck making decisions. They wanted a regular American who's going to fight for them to do so. And I think that's why they released this letter. It shows a regular American who wants to get our troops out. I don't understand some of it, why he'd say, I'll talk to you later. And he basically said,
don't be a fool.
If you do so, this would be evil. And it's just sort of this combination of multiple Twitter messages on a letter. But, then again, this is sort of, what you see is what you get with President Trump. And I just, the part I don't understand is why the impulsivity, why abandon the Kurd that allows the Turks to commit war crimes against them, when in fact, I can't see how if we had coalesced the rest of NATO and actually used the UN to put pressure and say, you know what, we'll pull out, but let's get other European powers, where your Erdogan just threatened to release 4 million refugees on Europe. If he's going to do that, why don't you guys come and put some troops here on the border and we'll get ours out, because you have much more at stake here. We could have made that argument. But instead, you can't help but start thinking of weird conspiracy theories about oil and other things that Russia wanted. I mean, I don't know what the right answer is and why we did this. But the bottom line is to do it ask for forgiveness rather than permission from the public, where I think the world, Europe, would have been on President Trump's side to say, we're not going to let Erdogan commit an offensive. Why do you think, by the way, why do you think Assad let him do that? He basically had an offensive incursion of troops into Syria, and nobody's saying, wait a minute, how do you have an invasion into a foreign power? Because Assad wants to clean out the Kurds, too.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think your criticism of the process and the impulsivity of it, I think, is a fair criticism. You really didn't prepare the public in any meaningful way. Not that you're supposed to telegraph foreign policy decisions, but you should telegraph a uneasiness with the troop presence still there and discussions with allies. And, you know, fine. You want to restate a warning to Erdogan and Turkey. That's fine to explain the fact that, you know, we can't be in these places forever with these sort of light footprints, dealing with the 100, 200 year old animosities. We accomplished what we intended to accomplish. And I said, I'm going to bring our men and women back home from Afghanistan and other places the world over where they're in harm's way for no particular strategic end. If he had said something like that before he had made the move, yeah, then I think it's more easy to sort of read along. But he didn't do that, so I can see where conservatives have problems with that. Now that said, just thinking about this in historical context, and maybe this informs some of Trump's perspective. I don't know either. I don't. This is all reading of tea leaves and tersely worded letters. But I just think about this. I was thinking about this morning, Dr. Jasser. So, you know, Charlie Wilson's war. We support the Mujahideen against the Soviets, but the lesson we're supposed to take away, the conventional lesson we're supposed to take away from Charlie Wilson's war, is we should have helped the Mujahideen rebuild Afghanistan, and thus it wouldn't have given rise, we ultimately wouldn't have given rise to the Taliban. We should have gone on to Baghdad in Gulf War I. Should have pursued the surge earlier in Iraq, and we should have sustained it rather than the troop withdrawal that Obama initiated. Against that backdrop, the duration of troop presence in places like Afghanistan and Iraq and the Middle East. And I think there's a fatigue factor. And I think we look at what's happened in North Africa and in the Middle East and say, we can't state build from afar. We don't want to be an occupying force. We have to have limited strategic goals because the larger utopian goals of democracy and pluralism and the relief of persecution the world over, it's just impossible for us to affect from this distance. And the American people don't have the appetite for the kind of footprint required to do so. They didn't even have the appetite to go into Rwanda during the Clinton administration and stop the genocide there, or Darfur. So we're just fatigued across the board, and we see these intermittent reports of soldiers being killed in action, and to what end? And this was sort of part of Trump's value proposition as a presidential candidate that he's trying to make good on, even if it's not necessarily with the processes that we'd otherwise and the communication style we'd otherwise like.
I don't disagree with any of that. I do think, though, we have to put it in context of where we are after 8 years of a disastrous pro-Iranian policy, where you have Iran with tens of thousands of troops on Israel's door, Hezbollah stronger than it's ever been in Syria, Assad re-strengthened, and Russia re-strengthened with its base. So now you have the Kurds, where you can't really, I think some of the talking points President Trump was giving actually were coming from Erdogan, which is that the PKK is worse than ISIS. That's absurd. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's no evidence at all in our decades of at least over a decade of working with the Kurds that they've ever been anything but a loyal, steadfast ally. Now, who are the Kurds? The Kurds are 40 million people, 10 in Iran, 10 in Iraq, 2 in Syria, and 6 to 8 in Turkey. So for the first time, most of my Kurdish friends have never said they wanted a Kurdistan as a state. They want a federal Syria. It's an autonomous area in Syria that even Assad was not able to take over and was protecting minorities. And now many of us for the first time are saying, you know what, the only reason the Kurds are being laid to waste is because they don't have a seat at the table as a nation state. And maybe they should have gotten a nation state because they wouldn't have been thrown under the bus repeatedly over and over. And I think strategically it doesn't serve our interest to think that somehow we can just from the air get rid of ISIS is absurd. Russia radicalizes Islamists everywhere they go, from Chechnya to Iran with Hezbollah. They love radical Islamists on the Shia side, and they use them when they need them, just like Assad shipped Al-Qaeda and ISIS into Iraq on government buses as we were there, and he'll continue to do so. So to think that we need no presence there from an intel perspective is absurd. And President Trump made the argument a year ago. He said, we're going to decrease troops to nothing. I'm going to pull them out from Syria. And we said, fine. We went down from 2,000 to 1,000, or 4,000 to 2,000, and we were going down. And now this troop, by the way, what happened last week was not a removal. It was a shift over to give Erdogan that area into the Qamishli corridor in northern Syria. So bottom line, this wasn't about stopping endless war. It triggered a war. And when the president removes troops, nobody's saying he can't do so. But imagine if tomorrow he said he's going to remove our troops from the DMZ in Korea.
Mm-hmm.
There were, you know, that could cause war, and yet there's no war right now in Korea. So there's a lot to say that America has a presence, whether we want it or not, existentially, even with just a few troops. And they're not being put there at danger, because I refuse to believe a NATO ally is going to openly start firing on our troops.
He is Dr. Zudi Jasser, president of the American Islamic Forum for Democracy, co-founder of the Muslim Reform Movement, former U.S. Navy lieutenant commander, and author of the book, A Battle for the Soul of Islam. Dr. Jasser, always a pleasure. Thank you for your insights.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
So the press corps caught up with Joe Biden in Columbus, doing a little campaign stop after the debate the other evening. And this is what he had to say about his boy Hunter.
The president of the United States says he wants to talk about corruption. Well, let's talk about corruption. He is running the most corrupt government in history of the United States of America, number one. Number two, he also is in a position where, as he talks about corruption, he is engaged in practices that, in fact, everyone around the world is looking and saying, how in God's name can this man be doing that while he's president? And look, Mr. President, you want to talk about corruption? I've released 21 years of my tax returns. I entered as one of the poorest men in Congress, left one of the poorest men in government, in Congress, and as vice president. I made no money while I was in there other than my salary. Mr. President, even Richard Nixon released his tax returns. Mr. President, release your tax returns or shut up.
So you wouldn't change anything?
Tough talk.
Don't regret anything?
No, I don't. And because I never discussed with my son anything having to do with what was going on in Ukraine. That's a fact.
That's not a fact. Or at least it's not a fact that Hunter stipulates to. In point of fact, he said again in his ABC interview, he keeps saying this and they keep letting him get away with this, that Hunter did have a conversation with his dad, Joe, about Burisma. So what Joe Biden is saying is not a fact, or at least it's a fact. It's a statement in dispute with his own son, number one. Number two, it is worth pointing out poor old Joe Biden riding the Acela to and fro Delaware. His net worth is about $11 million.
$11 million?
Yeah. So number one, those public salaries, one of the poorest members of Congress. Yes, I understand. That's technically true. But those salaries, boy, you can amass a lot of money over the course of 30 years, making $200,000 a year plus all the bennies, and then upping that to what, $400,000 or rough numbers when he became vice president. But the other thing, and this is the whole situation with Hunter, which is why his statement is disingenuous, it's how you leverage your public office, your time in public office, for the payoff after public office. That's the whole point. That's the kleptocracy. And how did he leverage it? He went from $400,000 in 2016 to $11 million in 2017 in terms of his annual income. So $400,000 in 2016, he's vice president. Calendar year 2017, $11 million. Why? A book deal with his friends and colleagues in the publishing world. You think, did Dan Quayle get an $11 million book deal?
No.
Yeah, right. It's a little bit different how the left is treated by those institutions than the right. But the point is, it's the discussion is, it's the same thing with Hunter. Maybe what he did wasn't technically illegal, but it is trafficking on public position for private gain. That is the corruption issue.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
This guy is the most biased reporter, NBC. I think CNN has more credibility than NBC.
On AM 560.
Did you hear what I said? I said you have more credibility than this guy. And that's not saying much.
The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. And by popular demand, and also because I think our next guest, PJ O'Rourke, will enjoy it, we played this yesterday, but it deserves a second airing. This commentary from a newsreader at Sky News Australia recounting a local op-ed with a message to the kiddies, including the adults, the adults that behave like kids when it comes to the end of the world. Think about the Socialist Spice Girls. Think about most of the Illinois congressional delegation. This commentary to them who are striking today, not for more money like Chicago public school teachers, but to save the world, to demand politicians do something, to ask the question, as Veruca Salt Thunberg did, how dare you?
To all the school kids going on strike for climate change, you're the first generation who've required air conditioning in every classroom. You want TV in every room, and your classes are all computerized. You spend all day and night on electronic devices. More than ever, you don't walk or ride bikes to school, but you arrive in caravans of private cars that choke suburban roads and worsen rush hour traffic. You're the biggest consumers of manufactured goods ever, and update perfectly good, expensive luxury items to stay trendy. Your entertainment comes from electric devices. Furthermore, the people driving your protests are the same people who insist on artificially inflating the population growth through immigration, which increases the need for energy, manufacturing and transport. The more people we have, the more forest and bushland we clear, the more of the environment that's destroyed. How about this? Tell your teachers to switch off the aircon, walk or ride to school, switch off your devices and read a book, make a sandwich instead of buying manufactured fast food. No, none of this will happen. Because, the piece says, you're selfish, badly educated, virtue-signalling little turds inspired by the adults around you who crave a feeling of having a noble cause while they indulge themselves in Western luxury and unprecedented quality of life. The piece ends by saying, wake up, grow up, and shut up.
I mean, I don't agree with every specific criticism, but I certainly do agree with the tone. For more on this, per his piece with a message to the woke walkers, we're pleased to be joined by noted humorist PJ O'Rourke, H.L. Mencken, research fellow at the Cato Institute, regular panelist on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, New York Times bestselling author of many, many books, Parliament of Horrors, Give War a Chance. And PJ O'Rourke, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, you are welcome, and thank you for that wonderful diatribe. I just wrote down, wake up, grow up, shut up, with a note to tell kids.
Yes, exactly.
My kids.
I think be sure you'd yell at them, too.
Sort of an update of Timothy Leary there, a bit of an up to 21st century updating
yes,
of that.
Exactly.
Now, I've been reading you since college, and I've had this long-running love affair with your work, but I'm afraid now that has to come to an end because you're taking on people that cannot be taken on, and I don't want to be sent to the woke gulag by promoting your work. You're welcoming back the Puritanism as so practiced by the left, but I sense a hint or two of sarcasm.
Just maybe a hint or two, yeah, and I can't blame you for not wanting to go to the safe space that they're going to send us all to. Yeah, I mean, I was down at the University of Virginia with my old friend Pat Oliphant, a wonderful editorial cartoonist, who's kind of lefty, you know, and I'm kind of righty, but we've been good friends for 30 years, And Oliphant has given up his, he doesn't draw anymore, his eyesight, macular degeneration and so on. He's getting old. And I'd like to retire myself. And we were talking about, hey, we're of no use anymore because, like, the clowns have taken over the circus. You know, I mean, bring back the, you know, we were there to make fun of the ringmasters, the elephants, you know, the trapeze artists, the high wire walkers. Now all we got is, like, the only thing left for us to do is to chase the clowns back into the tiny clown car, you know?
You don't, they're making a parody impossible is what you're suggesting.
Exactly. And then, just as I'm saying that, along comes the virtue signaling woke world, and suddenly we all have something to make fun of again. I am so thankful for to these kids.
And you mentioned in your article, to be woke is to maintain a state of mind where you're constantly and accurately alert to social injustice.
Yeah, which is, as I recall, is pretty much the definition of being 13, although all the social injustice was from dad and mom.
Yeah.
Because
we're the evil ones, because we want rules.
Well, yeah, you write that being woke is a parody of being born again. Instead of you're accepting Jesus, people like Jesus have to accept you.
Yes, because you see, Jesus, like a white male. Dead white male. Well, you know, yeah. I mean, if you're Christian, you don't believe
right.
so. But, you know,
right.
It was very well connected, the apostles, the disciples. Father, you know, he had like the whole, I mean, his dad was really well connected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Kind of ran the universe. Man.
Right. No, I recall the
privilege.
Stories. Yeah. Yeah. Privilege. Right. But here's the thing about it. You know, it's all fun and games until you're the subject of the bigot baiting and you're the instrument they're using to generate that solidarity and marginality that they so desire.
And you are so much more in danger. You and Amy are so much more in danger of that than I am, because one thing that these kids don't do is read. And I'm a print journalist.
You're safe.
Of course, that comes with its own set of problems, because you know, print journalism is like pretty much the deadest industry that you can imagine. You know, I mean, we make Youngstown and Akron and Dayton and the rest of the and Detroit and the rest of the Rust Belt, you know, look like Silicon Valley when it comes to print journalism. But anyway. Yeah, you're safe from them having, or I'm safe from them having read anything I wrote, but they do still listen occasionally.
Yeah, no, that's an underappreciated upside of nobody reading anymore. I appreciate that.
It really is. You can say anything.
You just have to do it in print. Right, there you go.
Yeah.
Where do you see this train going with conductors like Ocasio-Cortez and her cadre and newly woke Joe Biden?
Yeah, I know. Joe, go back to sleep.
I know. Even when he tried to attack Elizabeth Warren yesterday, my eyes rolled over.
I know.
I mean, it was so boring.
I love the fact that this is like the entire, like, sort of leading edge of the Democratic nomination race is being led by people who are older than I am. And I was around when mastodons and Nixon roamed the earth.
but here's the thing. I mean, as somebody who's given to a rhetorical flourish or two, you must appreciate the fabulists that are running for president on the Democrat side. We'll just stick there for now. I mean, Elizabeth Warren's had a number of heroic tales that she tells about herself. None of them are true, but they're heroic nonetheless. Cory Booker has an imaginary friend. Joe Biden keeps telling stories about him and corn pop back in the hood, back in the day. So, I mean, that's a lot of material there.
It really is. You know, they are doing they're doing a fabulous job. Yeah, Democrats seem to be operating on the thesis that nobody can lose to Trump, and by golly, they're going to find that nobody.
And what do you think about Elizabeth Warren, though, saying that she was fired from her teaching position because she was pregnant, and then it turns out, oh, that's not really what happened.
Yeah, well, you know, she has been known to slightly stretch the truth. But gee, you know, politicians lying, my jaw drops.
Yeah.
You know, knock me over with a feather. It's what they do for a living. You know, it's when they tell the truth that things get scary.
Right. When they agree, when the two sides agree, that's even the scariest
agree,
of all.
Yeah, that's what I've always said, that frightening words in Washington, bipartisan consensus, because that's like when my doctor and my lawyer agree with my wife that I need help.
I know you're still using papyrus and quill writing instruments, but in the era of big tech, what's your reaction to those, to sort of across the spectrum, that are railing against big tech, the social media platforms, from a variety of perspectives, one being censorship, the other just being too much market control?
Well, it is scary, you know. I mean, it's the it is scary that about three or four of these firms, you know, control virtually everything that comes onto our screen. There is a little button kind of around on the back of the computer that I found the other day, that when you hit it, it goes off. So that'd be one response to the scary techno giants. The other is, you know, when it comes down to this is a situation that will sort itself out by itself, although it may take some time and pain, because when it comes right down to it, a tech platform doesn't have that high a bar of entry. That is to say, you don't have to build a factory. It's not like competing with GM. You know, you don't have to build a factory, design a car, and all this. I mean, you just have to get like six nerds, you know, fresh out of computer programming school. You know, pay them minimum wage, promise them a lot of stock options, and you can create another platform. So I think that in the end, the free market's a painful way of doing things, but in the end, it's effective.
All right. Well, we'll end there on that optimistic note. And by the way, my favorite line from your Puritanism is Back piece at Spectator.us, Japes at Tartuffian can't begin anew, or can begin anew, excuse me.
Should send the little devils to the dictionary if they know what it is.
You know, if I've said this once, I've said it a million times. There are not enough Molière references in political and cultural commentary. And so
this
I appreciate
so
that.
True. It's a tragedy of our times.
PJ O'Rourke, H.L. Mencken, research fellow at the Cato Institute, a regular panelist at NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and New York Times bestselling author of so many books, Parliament of Horrors, Give War a Chance, Republican Party Reptile, and so on. Thanks so much for joining us, PJ. Appreciate it.
Oh, you're so welcome. It's a good talk to you guys.
Oh, you're the best. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, how's this for a Chamber of Commerce pitch? The Oak Parker tweeting out, are you looking to get away from your homogenous white bread community for something with a cosmopolitan feel? Check out Oak Park and drop in to the Housing Center for our free apartment referral services. Contact us today.
Wow.
Looking to get out of your white bread community for something with a cosmopolitan feel. And stay for the cosmopolitan, or come for the cosmopolitan feel, I should say, and stay for the property taxes that are 6% of your home value. Because once you come, you're not going to be able to get out, or at least you're not going to be able to get out from underneath your home. Boy, I think I've got the ideal spokesperson for the Oak Parker.
Oh, I think I know who she is.
Susan Buchanan.
Yeah.
Trustee Susan Buchanan.
How's she doing?
She's doing fine so long as white people, particularly men, shut their faces while she's crafting the town's diversity statement. All right.
And she's white, too.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
It's Groundhog Day! Get up and sit your hog out there! Yeah!
Yeah, it's Groundhog Day. It feels like it's 2012 all over again. Chicago teachers are on strike, officially on the picket line. Everybody's doing it for the kids. And I don't know where Peyton and Eli are, but I expected them to be here to do some errands for me today since they don't have school. So what happened?
Well, they're sleeping in. I thought I'd let them sleep
in today. Must
be nice. Well, yesterday they had a football game, and I think Peyton's a little sore from that whooping that they gave to Von Steuben, 40-0.
Uh-huh.
But I know you don't care about that stuff, because I don't either. I mean, they won the game. But if they don't settle the strike by October 30th, then their hopes for being in the state playoffs are going to be demolished.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you heard, watched Channel 5 News last night.
As the impact on students and student athletes, one CPS mom we spoke with today is concerned about her two sons' football careers, how they could be affected by the strike. They both play football for Evanston High School, and they are standout players. The team is on a hot streak right now with its best record in two decades. They're 6-1.
They need to play this game, absolutely.
Just like in life as well as football, things are going to happen that you're not prepared for. But it's not what happens to you. It's how you react to it.
Yeah, that's the football Vikings coach, okay? Just so you know.
I'm glad
words
to know.
To live by.
I'm glad to know that the NBC news readers will read anything that you write. That is the top line with Chicago Public School, the Chicago teacher strike and the public schools being closed. The top line is one Lakeview mom who's concerned about the football careers of her two sons.
Well, because if they cancel the season, then there goes some possible scholarship.
Yeah.
Here is Juanita Askew.
It shouldn't have gotten this far. You know, like everyone knew that these negotiations needed to take place when the school year started. Like by now, it should have been taken care of.
Should have been taken care of by now. But this is just CTU letting Lori Lightfoot know who's the boss.
Well, I'll tell you what, who's the boss. I believe in Community, it was proven scientifically that Angela was the boss.
Who?
Angela on Who's the Boss.
Oh,
Angela
right.
was the boss, not Tony.
Yeah.
Yeah. But with respect to CTU, we know the taxpayers aren't the boss. We know that the politicians aren't the boss. We know the public sector unions are because they're the boss in Chicago. They're the boss in Illinois. They have been for some time. There's no surprise here, which is why we're literally having the same conversation that we had 7 years ago, the last teacher strike. It's the same dynamic between the mayor, the little mayor. We had a different little mayor back then. We've got a new little mayor now. Same exact conversation, same exact posture, which is supine. Same exact blank check that's being offered that was going to be signed with your names, by the way. You're going to be on the hook for it if you're a Chicago resident in particular, but not limited, because I will remind people in Chicagoland and throughout the rest of the state that the majority of CPS funding comes from the state. All Illinois taxpayers on the hook for this. And, oh, by the way, what do we have at CPS? The only thing different between now and 7 years ago is the depth of the hole that CPS is in. $17 billion. That's the difference between assets on hand to pay bills and bills that are due, encumbrances that have been incurred. $17 billion. Okay, sure. But that doesn't stop CTU from making demands about nurse staffing and about social worker staffing, in addition to the 16% step increases, 25% increase over 4 years. Of course it doesn't. It doesn't stop CTU from saying we'll continue to have almost three-fourths of the employee contribution to their pensions picked up by the school system, meaning the taxpayers. So effectively, Chicago teachers, again, already the highest paid teachers in the nation, adjusted for cost of living prior to this strike, prior to this contract, will then just extend their lead over New York City teachers and will continue to roughly contribute $40,000 to their pension in return for a guaranteed $2.1 million out, $2.2 million net present value pensions. And if you don't like that, then you're anti-teacher. If you think, for example, the fact that CPS has overspent its budget 15 years straight by a total of $6.6 billion is problematic, then you don't like teachers, and you're racist, too. If you think that, for example, Chicago property taxes increasing by 50% in real dollars over the past 20 years, while enrollment in CPS has actually shrunk by 22,000 students, then you're a racist and you don't like teachers. Are we clear? So now we're all just going to shut up and go along with it, and we'll parrot the lines. It's for the kids. I like teachers. I like principals. I like administrators. I love my elected overlords. I love the Chicago and Illinois electorate. Thank you for your service, your dedicated public servants, your selfless, your other regarding, your heroes. And I just hope and pray this gets settled, because it should have been settled long ago. And whatever numbers you need to write on that blank check to settle it, you just do that. And then, of course, we'll figure it out, because we always do. Everything is going well in Chicago and Illinois. This will all get figured out. We don't have to worry about math. Those are just opinions. There's people that prattle on like me about math. It's an opinion. It's a Republican Party talking point. It's a conservative, hateful rant. And that should be ignored and dismissed out of hand.
Well, should the teachers be replaced? Should Lori Lightfoot do the big move, what Ronald Reagan did with air traffic controllers, and replace them all?
You know, I think we're all sort of checked out on that, Amy. I think that's a fun question. But let me just suggest this piece from Loop North News, a little local flavor on the housing market in the areas that support the city. Again, half a dozen wards that provide most of, like, the supermajority of tax dollars to the city. They're calling it a cricket housing market. A crickets market.
The Don Lemon market? No, I'm kidding.
No, different.
Scratch word.
Yes, thankfully they're not doing that. Cookies went uneaten. Coffee turned cold in the pot. Colorful helium-filled balloons decorating the front porches of homes for sale gradually went flat. Oh, nothing like a Kevlar balloon going flat. A Mylar.
Mylar balloon.
Kevlar would be. That'd be something. That'd be different.
That would be very.
If you could make a Kevlar balloon,
okay, balloon
I'd like to see that. Yeah. I'm thinking about the Kevlar you need to wear in the city.
Right.
Not the Mylar balloons. Excuse my confusion. There's radio silence. Right. This Don DeBat writing. There's radio silence throughout the city and the suburbs, from downtown Chicago to Lake Forest, Oak Park to St. Charles. Oak Park? I thought that's, you know, where people move when they're looking to get out of their white bread community. Oh, no. Radio silence. The only properties that are moving are priced under 500 grand, observed three city and suburban brokers. The demand for homes with more than 3,000 square feet, inventory period three times as long as those with less than 3,000 square feet. Just pointing up the fact again, you get above 500 grand, Godspeed to you. I've never seen the city home market this slow, even during the Great Recession of 2008. Observed another veteran Northside broker. Boy, that's a statement, isn't it? Huh. Well, I'm sorry. You're going to have to stick it out and just continue to pay the confiscatory property taxes that you've gotten used to, because if you don't, and if you complain about it, then you hate children, you hate teachers, and you're a racist. All right? That's simple. So just buck up and bear it, because what are you going to do? You're not going to get involved. You're just going to quietly leave. Like, for example, the 9,200 tax filers earning $200,000 or more who left Illinois in 2016 alone. 4,700 such filers moved in. The net loss of 4,500 wealthy Illinois tax filers. On net basis, Illinois lost more wealthy residents per capita in 2016 than any other state in the nation except New York. And how do you think that's going since 2016 and 17 and 18 and now in 19? And what do you think the trajectory is? By the way, how big is are these numbers? 11% of tax filers is what's represented by those with $200,000 or more in Illinois, representing half of the adjusted gross income lost in 2016. In other words, those 4,500 net filers, those 4,500 net $200,000 filers who left the state, are part of a cohort that represents $2.5 billion in lost adjusted gross income. $2.5 billion. The lost GDP from the exodus just over the last 5 years is in the tens of billions of dollars. Job growth is anemic in Illinois. And, of course, we have continued to have stories like company that left Illinois for Hammond. After just a mere 98 years in Bridgeport in Chicago. Yeah. Midland Metal Products, 700 South Wabash Avenue, no more. Now they're in Hammond. 135 employees. Invested $7 million in a 112,000 square foot plant, which is bigger than the one they had in Bridgeport. Employs about 135 workers and is still hiring. The president of the company, Marcus McDonald, said the company faced too much uncertainty about its cost in Illinois. Quote, this location in Hammond and this facility were the perfect solution. Yeah. All right. So what do you think? Enrollment down, property taxes up. What about the teachers? Don't administer the basic skills test anymore? 20 years ago, you had 10% that fail it. It's a test that's so easy, a high school freshman is supposed to be able to pass it. But all of them are artists. There's quality control in the teaching core there in CPS, do you think? And what about the good teachers who leave because they can't do what they got into teaching to do in CPS, which is instill a love of learning in children because of the sclerotic system? Any concern for them? No, I know. I know. The curriculum. You want to talk about that? Why they mainly teach foreign languages in high school rather than grade school, despite the research we know about how kids learn. Why the first...
But our suburban schools did that, too.
And
doesn't make it right.
And so? And so? Why they teach... But biology is the first science class high school freshmen take when we know in point of fact it should be the third after a physical science course and chemistry. That's how kids best learn science. Why? Why do those things happen? Anybody care about 500 plus kids being allegedly sexually abused over just the last decade? The last decade, that includes most of the time from strike to strike. CTU didn't even bother to participate in the internal inquiry into that systemic sexual abuse of children in CPS. Jesse Sharkey's invitation got lost in a spam filter. Anybody want to talk about that? No? Don't care? Black and brown kids, poor kids, not my kids. What is it? Is there anything that can get people to care? Is there anything that can get people to do anything? Or are you just going to be shut up and backed down by people who say, it's for the kids. If you oppose the blank check, then you're anti-teacher, principal, administrator, education of black and brown children, as if CPS is educating black and brown children. Anybody care about, I don't know, anybody ask Chicago Press Corps about these vacant schools that are staffed as if they weren't?
There's a lot of vacant schools.
Some people do. 1 in 10 City of Chicago property owners didn't pay real estate taxes in 2018. They're going galt. Schools. Harper on the south side has 172 students. Once had 4,400. Fanger, 223 students. Down from 5,300.
And how does that, 5,300 to 200 students, that's amazing.
Hirsch, 147 students, once had 3,280.
Wow.
Go on and on and on. 42% of more than, of some five dozen high schools we looked at were less than half filled. 42 of the 59 we looked at were less than half filled. That's 71%. 12 of 59 high schools, less than 10% of what they once had. Those 12, Team Inglewood, Harper, Fanger, Hirsch, Douglas, Robeson, Marshall, Manley, Bowen, Gage Park, Hope, Ronsville. Anybody want to talk about that? No, don't care. You just want this binary of like, oh, Lori Lightfoot good, Lori Lightfoot bad, CTU good, CTU bad, teachers good, teachers bad. It's for the kids. It's not for the kids. Does anybody care about anything? The finances, the quality of education, the safety of kids in the schools, the actual capacity, the population versus the capacity. Anything. What it's doing to home values, the blank checks that are being written with your name signed.
Well, there is one point of contention which I agree with, and that's that schools on the north side have much more than schools on the south side.
We have things here that they don't have on the south side. And our brothers and sisters who are there on the south side suffer more than we do.
What is it? What do they have?
Well, the school nurse, for instance, a lot of schools on the north side, we have a school nurse. They have a school nurse that comes once a day, or one day a week, excuse me, to certain schools that are middle schools and elementary schools. So they want a nurse, yeah, and they want a social worker if there's 800-plus kids in the school.
Yeah, I assume,
but it sounds like there's no one in the schools on the south and west side from what your those numbers you just read.
Yeah, and I assume that's supposed to be sarcasm. That's a joke, right? That's not a serious position that anybody's taking, I hope. Is that a serious position? 500 kids plus have alleged they've been sexually abused in the last decade. And you want to talk about how many days a school nurse is appearing at one particular school? That's been hollowed out if you're comparing North versus South Side, where the South Side is where the schools have been hollowed out. That's what you want to talk about? The social worker? For what? The problem with this criminal enterprise called CPS is that we don't have enough staff. It's not what's being afforded or not afforded the kids. We can't figure it out. We can't make it go $25,000 per high school graduate per year. Not enough. I remember during the 2012 strike, at least when we had Jesse Sharkey on the show, before he got too sheepish to come on the shows and deal with people like me, just settle to deal with your colleagues at NBC and the other Chicago Press Corps outlets that are jokes. At least he admitted, well, how much more money do you need? I just asked him, what's the number? Just give me a number already. Stop telling me more, 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 more. He said another $3 billion. That was 7 years ago. And now we're there and he wants $3 billion. Okay. At least he's honest. Is Lori Lightfoot honest? She's not. I'll skip ahead. I'll refer you to the answer key. Marty in Naperville, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, Marty.
Marty, go. Marty, gone.
You'd be gone.
Keith in Grand Park.
Hey, Dan. I think the voters of Illinois understand your math. It's pretty easy to follow. They just don't care. I think their pension checks that are coming in, their disability checks that are coming in, they want the scam to continue. It's continued for 50 years, so why? They just don't think the scam will ever end, so just keep riding the wave.
Yeah, exactly. I agree. That's right. So ride it. Sean in Elmwood Park.
Now I know why you're dressed like the Tidy Bowl Man, Prof. It's over. You're going down the drain. And I'll tell you another thing. It's not just the Sharkies of the world. It's the parents. Listen to the mother. The biggest thing she's concerned about is the football game. Oh, really, honey? Is that what bothers you? How many of the parents can't wait to drop their kids off for their free breakfast, for their free lunch, for their free afternoon snack? How many send 4 and 5 and 6 kids and pretend that they pay their property taxes when half are renters? Or they pretend that they have it coming. It's the character of the Chicagoan, and it deserves to be flushed. They're socialists pretending they have dignity. You have none. You pay for your kid's school, you pack the lunch in the morning, and you worry if they learn their homework. Not if they can catch a ball, dimwit.
Oh, you know who that parent is, Sean.
Me. I'm the guy packing the
lunch. No. The mom and the football players.
I know. She's the sexy one, like a question mark. I know who she is.
Thanks, Sean.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning. Little note here. I'd like to thank Somras. Somras is this... spirits outfit.
Yeah, and this Friday and Saturday, you can sample artesian chocolates, wines, and liqueurs and spirits from vendors like Somras that make mango and chai rum creams.
They're pouring at the Chicago Wine and Spirits Expo, and I am trying their chai cream liqueur in my coffee this morning.
And what do you think?
It's helping me indulge and endure the rhetoric coming from the Chicago Teachers Union.
Uh-huh.
So I appreciate that, Samaras, well-timed with your delivery of these liqueurs.
And real quick,
thank you very much.
Chocolate Wine and Spirits Expo includes free parking in the West Loop and over 40 artisans with proceeds benefiting Chicago Canine Rescue. Secure your tickets today. Go to gourmetexpo.com, gourmetexpo.com.
All right. Joshua Mitchell is an academic at Georgetown University, visiting fellow in American political thought, and he is the B. Kenneth Simon Center for Principles and Politics at the Heritage Foundation, the fellow there. He has written an interesting piece in National Affairs, nationalaffairs.com, which I'll tweet out, Why Conservatives Struggle with Identity Politics. Why conservatives are so bad at confronting the identitarians that you saw on stage this week, those 12, the AOC and other backbenching freshmen behind them, driving them really further and deeper into identity politics. We're pleased to be welcome Josh Mitchell to the show. Josh, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, Dan. Glad to be here.
Thanks for joining us. And so you start out by presenting sort of the two different definitions of identity. One, rather innocuous, the one that's employed by the identitarians, less so.
Yes. So 30 years ago, those of us who remember, we would say, I'm an American, I'm a this, I'm a that. But now the word identity is everywhere we look. And if it just means, well, I'm an American, that's fine. Except that I think what's happened is that identity now means something more. It's a relationship between those who are pure and those who are stained. And the name of the game in identity politics is to figure out how many purity points you have. And you set all this, you set your purity points against the one prime transgressor, which is the white male heterosexual. And I'm going to be clear, I'm not defending, you know, white identity. Trust me, that's not what I'm up to. What I'm saying is we have a sickness in America right now where the only thing that we're concerned about is how pure you are. And we saw this on the Democratic stage, everybody trying to out-pure each other. And my argument is what we should be doing instead is paying attention to building a world together. So I set up the contrast between the politics of innocence, which is what identity politics is all about, versus the politics of competence. And Americans are about competence and about building a world together, and that's where we need to go.
What about the victimizing themselves? Because everyone seems to try to garner votes by saying, well, I know what you're feeling because I, too, was, you know, what Elizabeth Warren said, was fired because I was pregnant. Which we know now that was not to be true. But do you think that they really are scoring points with the American public by becoming a victim or painting themselves as a victim?
I think that's the game they're playing. So my argument is that the Republicans were given a gift by Trump because he imploded the old Republican Party, and now we're in the process of rebuilding. The Democrats haven't figured out that identity politics among the mass of Americans is over, and Trump is going to win resoundingly because of this. The sick thing we have now in our country is that in order to be heard, we have to somehow have an innocence category. It's not about how competent we are. It's how innocent we are. And you simply cannot build a world if we're not concerned about competence. So we have to return to what I call the politics of competence.
Let me rewind for a minute. Trump blew up the Republican Party, the old Republican Party. Some Republicans want to go back to the halcyon days of a Mitt Romney and a John McCain and a compassionate conservative George W. Bush. Why was that a good thing, and why can't we go back?
My view, again, I'm old enough to remember what happened when Reagan took over the party in 1980. There was a group called the Rockefeller Republicans who thought, well, we'll put up with this guy for 4 years, and then we'll take back our party, and it never happened. And my view is, while I have many, many friends who are neoconservatives, and I'm actually, while I was affiliated with Heritage last year, I'm actually out in the Middle East right now, and I've been there off and on for 14 years helping to build universities. So I went to Iraq after the war. So I know what's there. I look it up. I was the chancellor of the American University of Iraq in Sulaymaniyah for 2 years. But my view is that we don't have any business spending blood and treasure in the Middle East trying to build democracy. Many of my students out there believe that constitutional monarchy is the highest political form. We have problems in Asia that we're going to have to face big time. So I think the Republican Party that was blown up had two parts of it. One was that free markets without concern with the middle class That is no longer going to work. And the second part is democracy exportation abroad without regard to cost, both to us and to overseas peoples. That's gone too. So I think the new nationalism is very healthy. I think the return to the middle class is very healthy. And I think the new Republican Party will be built around that. There's still a lot of infighting. There's still people who believe in pure free markets. And even if that means the middle class of America is collateral damage, that's fine with them. That's a problem. I think that's over. So the Republicans are actually in a rebuild phase. The Democrats think they just didn't go far enough. They just need to keep going down, doubling down on the identity politics. And Trump is for them the opportunity for every white person to demonstrate that they too are not transgressors. They're innocent victims. They hate Trump. They have to scapegoat Trump. So there's a profound kind of religious need to scapegoat in America right now. And the brilliance of America is that we've had all sorts of peoples come through, and they've let down, let behind, let go of their national origins and decide they're going to be Americans and build a world together. And the left doesn't want to do that. They don't want to lose track of their identities. They want to double down on them. And they're not concerned with building a world with their neighbor. They're simply concerned with declaring to their neighbor how pure they are. Well, you can't build a country that way. So they will lose again.
Well, so here's the thing. You suggest that conservatives have responded quite poorly to the emergence of identity politics. But so if they've responded quite poorly, how is it that that you feel the left is overreaching while conservatives are rebuilding the Republican Party? It would seem to me that those two things are in conflict. Yeah.
Well, I'll put it this way. So I live out on the eastern shore of Maryland, which is a fairly poor place. And I will put it this way. I think the American people as a whole, and certainly the flyover country, realizes this the identity politics is a dead end. The thing that saddens me about the Republican Party is while the base has got its act together, that identity politics is over, the elites, the Republican Party, the thinking people who are writing stuff, they are still battling the old demon. So it's Marxism, and yes, there's hints of socialism coming out of the left, but the real enemy is not Marxism right now. The real enemy isn't multiculturalism right now. That's 1990s stuff. The real enemy is identity politics, and it frustrates me that they don't understand what it's up to, that it really is a politics of purity and stain. Marxism isn't a politics of purity and stain, and nor was multiculturalism. So I think we have to see this as a profoundly dysfunctional, it's frankly Protestantism in a new form. And I mean by that, what happened with the collapse of the mainline churches in America in the 1960s was that the category of purity and stain, which is a religious category, it's a theological category. Man is broken. Man is sinful. He is stained, all of us, whether you're white or not. We all bear the mark of Adam, so to speak. What happened was the collapse of the mainline churches didn't mean the end of religion. There's all this talk about how America is now secular. It's not. It's the most religious country in the world. It's just we get our religion, namely our understanding of purity and stain, not in the churches anymore, but out in politics. So my argument is that what's happened in America right now is we have this religious awakening among the Democratic elites. They're concerned with purity and stain. Republican elites don't really get that. They want to treat it as some species of multiculturalism or whatever. We have to see this as a religious movement, as a very bad Christian religious movement. And I think conservatives who talk about religious values, this is the irony, they talk about religious values, they talk about religious liberty, but they don't see that right in front of them is this deeply distorted Christianity that is, on the one hand, as I said, concerned with purity and stain. On the other hand, is concerned with scapegoating. And if you're a Christian, you understand that the divine Son of God is the scapegoat who took upon himself the sins of the world. Well, what we have with identity politics is one particular group, the white heterosexual male, who's the scapegoat who takes upon himself the sins of the world. It's deeply distorted Christianity, and I don't think the intellectuals on the right fully understand that yet. There's a lot of talk about this American awakening. There's people out there who are getting hints of it, but I don't think anybody has yet fully nailed it.
But I mean, the suggestion you're making is that there's the politics as religion, and so the martyrs are now these propagators of identity politics, or their targets, or some combination of the two. So how does that play itself out if these These folks, I mean, a good example of this. Let me see if I can formulate this with an example. Garrison Keillor this week said essentially, I was wrongly accused as sexually harassing anybody. But if it takes my career being destroyed by this false allegation to advance the larger goals of Me Too, then I'm willing to throw myself on the pyre. I mean, that's sort of a sense of martyrdom. Isn't that particularly pernicious and misplaced? I guess that's a distorted version of Christianity you're describing.
Yeah. So what's happened is, you know, if you're certainly if you're a white male, and again, please understand me, I'm not saying, you know, we need to defend white men. That's what I'm saying. I'm saying the whole problem is the way we're thinking about this. White men have to show that they're pure. And so woke capitalism, for example, or men who double down on the feminist cause in order to show that they too are, they're not transgressors, they're on the side of the innocents. I mean, immense amount of psychic energy today is spent by especially the younger generation of white young people, white boys especially, trying to show that they're not transgressors because they Right. walk into a room and they're labeled as impure. And so they have to somehow figure out a way to increase their innocence point. So they support green climate new deals. They march for the Me Too movement. They're desperate to try to show the world that they're innocent. And this is a kind of sickness. The rule of law took hundreds and hundreds of years to develop. And the presumption in the rule of law is that we start by being innocent and we have to be proven guilty. Identity politics reverses that. So I'm out at Georgetown's campus in Qatar right now. There's a discussion among the students. They're trying to petition the faculty members to sign a petition at the beginning of each class, each semester, in which they say, we won't assault you. So the presumption is that men are rapists.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
The presumption
yeah.
is that men are rapists. Now, right. I want to be clear. In my HR documentation, I can get free saunas. I can get free mental health checkups. I get all these things as long as I acknowledge that I'm basically a rapist and I won't rape. I mean, this is the kind of sickness that we're faced with right now.
So then
the
what,
presumption of guilt.
Yes. Yeah, so no, OK. So that's a clear diagnosis. I get that. And then so what's the way forward that the sort of the new Republican Party, the new conservative movement is supposed to provide?
Well, I think out in the field, everybody knows that this is just ridiculous. It can't be that we're presumed guilty. So I think that's on the ground. People get this. The other piece of this puzzle, which we have not yet talked about, is that the Democratic Party has used Black America to do this. So there is an obvious wound that we're still suffering from in America. I think the Republicans are in a way wrong by saying, well, we don't have to worry about it. You know, America is this pure country. And Democrats are absolutely wrong by saying America is this irredeemably stained nation. We still have this wound to be healed. My argument is that what happened was that the women's movement, the gay and lesbian movement, and more recently the transsexual movement, has appropriated the moral mantle of Black Americans and said, see, just as civil rights goes to women's rights, that then goes to gay rights, that then goes to transgender rights. And so the whole thing is built upon the legitimate or the wound that we really do have to address. And I think in face-to-face relations we have to address this. But I think the only ones that can stop this in America are Black Americans. They're the ones who can stand up and say, you know what? Slavery did something that no other group had to go through. Namely, it destroyed families. Full stop. And that means there is a special case here that we have to address in America. And that means helping the least among us, both Black and white, to re-substantiate the generative family between a man and a woman. And everyone who comes from poor communities who's dug their way out knows it's the family and the churches that matter. So I frankly think that it's the African Americans who have the moral authority to say to the Democratic Party, no. The civil rights movement was one thing. However, it is another thing entirely to have all these other groups, all these other innocent, so-called innocent victims, carry the moral mantle of the African-American community. So I think the only group that can stop it is Black Americans. And they still have the moral authority. I mean, they had it in the 1960s with Martin Luther King, and they have it now.
Very interesting. He is Professor Joshua Mitchell, professor of political theory at Georgetown University. And again, I'll tweet out his piece at nationalaffairs.com, which is obviously worth a read, Why Conservatives Struggle with Identity Politics. Professor, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, Dan. Thank you.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.